You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, kids aren't the only ones rebelling against extinction.
Four of us were arrested. We blocked a three-lane main road in from Quebec.
Forget politicians. Citizens' assemblies are the way to go.
There is actually quite a bit of demand for citizens' assemblies. 65% of the American public believe that everyday people selected by lottery who meet some basic requirements and are willing and able to serve would actually perform better or much better compared with elected politicians.
And channeling Johnny Cash for adoring fans in France and Germany.
The reason for my being was music and for me to get up on stage. The reason that I had learned the theater craft was an excuse for me to get on stage.
Time is on my side. Okay. Quelque chose comme hurt après. Don't for hurt. Ta, ta, ba, ba, brum.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Before getting down to it, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Youth and protest. These are words that go together well. Older folks protest too. Many have been doing it for years. Michael Polanyi was in his 20s when he committed his first act of public disobedience. I recall walking into a room back then, seeing Michael getting his blood withdrawn. It would end up getting tossed on an outer wall of the Canadian Department of War in protest against low-level jet fighter training in Labrador over Indigenous Innu land. Fast forward, Michael is now 60 and still protesting. Just the other day, worried about wildfires sweeping across Canada, thousands of them, devastating splendid forests. Michael hopped into a car, drove over to a big highway outside Ottawa, and, well, I'll let Michael tell the story. Hello, Michael Polanyi. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
It's good to be with you, David.
Michael, tell me about what's just happened with you and your comrades in Ottawa.
This morning, I was with three others from a group called On to Ottawa that has been organizing a series of nonviolent civil disobedience actions in Ottawa to bring attention to the climate crisis and try to pressure the government of Canada to more seriously respond to the crisis, and especially the wildfire crisis that is burning across Canada. So four of us were arrested. We blocked a three-lane main road in from Quebec, Gatineau, over the Ottawa River into Ottawa.
Which highway?
It's the Portage Bridge. That's what it's known as. There are three or four bridges that go from Quebec into Ontario, and a lot of traffic on weekday mornings as many government employees are going to work. So we shut down the southbound lanes of this main road for about half an hour before being removed by the police and charged with mischief.
How many of you were there?
There were four of us blocking a three-lane road, so that was a little bit hairy. I was surprised that the drivers were so eager to get to work, but many of them were, and some of them drove right around us going up on the curb. One driver drove between two of us, so that was a little bit uncomfortable. Few drivers got out, yelled at us. One grabbed our banner and demolished it. One driver pulled me away, dragged me kind of out of the way. I got up and got back in the way. But it took the police quite a long time. It seemed like an eternity till the police finally came. It was probably about 20 or 30 minutes. But once they came, things calmed down a lot a lot, and proceedings went fairly quickly after that.
Now, Michael, you're a lot of people listening out there don't know who Michael Polanyi is. I'm not asking you to give us your complete curriculum vitae, who you are, but you're a professional, university educated chap. How old are you?
I turned 60 in a couple of months.
So do you want to tell folks a little bit about yourself and why someone like you, why you would drive up together with a bunch of friends up along a heavily trafficked highway leading into Canada's capital and stop your vehicle and get out and blockade traffic because of climate change, climate crisis? Why would you do this?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not a decision I took lightly. I've been deeply concerned about the growing climate crisis for probably 25 years now. I've had dozens, if not hundreds, of meetings with politicians. I've organized various community groups to put pressure on government. I've certainly been in dozens, probably hundreds of marches. And I think what I see at this point is a situation where our government in Canada, governments around the world have, especially in developed countries, have stalled and put off reducing emissions. And we're seeing the resultant effects of that in the form of wide-scale fires, floods, storms, heat waves, which are displacing and harming now thousands, if not millions of people. We're seeing the crisis upon us, and we know that the UN is quite clear. If we don't cut emissions by 50% before 2030, there's little chance we'll keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, which doesn't sound like much, but it's an important level that involves massive tipping points in terms of harm for hundreds of millions of people. So we're running out of time. I'm running out of time to go in marches and meet with politicians. I really believe in the tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience. If you look historically at the successful social change movements in this past century, the previous century, you see that often many of those movements had a component of people who were willing to risk arrest, were willing to risk imprisonment, were willing to risk violence brought on by nonviolent resistance, and were unwilling to consent to the continuation of violation of basic human rights. And I think what we're seeing today is a mass violation of the basic human right to survival. And I don't think governments will act with the urgency needed until citizens around the world make business as usual too costly to continue. And I think a key component of that will be nonviolent civil disobedience. And I want to be part of that.
And Michael Polanyi, quite a number of years ago, back in the 80s, you were engaged in this kind of nonviolent civil disobedience. And if I'm not mistaken, you've been arrested in the past. Can you go back and share a little bit of this history with us?
Yeah, I was a student, undergraduate student in Hamilton at McMaster University in the 1980s. People who are as old as me remember that was a time of great fear in the Cold War, in the arms race, in the election of right-wing politicians who were keen on expanding armaments and threatening the use of nuclear weapons, such as Ronald Reagan to the south of us. And I was kind of lucky to be, well, first of all, to have the opportunity to engage in a burgeoning peace movement that was in existence in Canada and many other countries, but also to be in a university environment with thoughtful, committed, principled, educated, wonderful people, both faculty members and students. So that's really where I got exposed to nonviolent civil disobedience as a protest approach. We were reading The Politics of Nonviolent Action by Gene Sharp. The new generation of activists is reading a new generation of authors who kind of come to the same conclusion that their range of tools that can be used to resist injustice, that state power, although it seems very durable, is actually dependent on the obedience and the acceptance of authority. And when citizens in large numbers creatively and nonviolently withdraw their consent, the authority of states is challenged and diminishes, and policies change. And I think there's hundreds of examples of successful movements. Gene Sharp, I think, talks about 250 methods of nonviolent action. And I think that civil disobedience made a difference in the peace movement. I know one of the big struggles was showing solidarity to Innu communities in the Labrador area who were fighting against low-level military jet testing by NATO countries. And that was an example where of kind of an early example. I mean, there are a lot of examples of Indigenous solidarity now. This was 40 years ago. And I think it was an example of a situation where people from across Canada stood with Indigenous people in our country and helped reduce and for a while eliminate low-level flight testing over their lands, which was harming their traditional ways of life. So that's just one example. There were many examples of civil disobedience in the peace movement, and that was a formative time for me.
And you went over the wire at Lytton, didn't you?
No, actually, I did not. I knew many people. I did attend protests at Lytton. I protested at ArmX, which was a weapons exhibit hosted by Canada, attended by various kind of dictatorships from around the world. So I protested there, and I protested in Toronto when we, I think it was 1988, the G7 leaders came to Toronto, and creatively activists held a kind of mock war crimes tribunal and attempted to issue citizen arrests to the various leaders, Helmut Kohl and George Bush and Margaret Thatcher, and in turn, of course, were arrested themselves, the protesters, that is. But those are some of the actions. I was arrested during the first Gulf War in 1991 in Hamilton. We blockaded a Canadian Armed Forces recruitment center. And then 3 years ago, there was probably a hiatus there. I was raising kids and a little less politically engaged. But increasingly over the past few years, I've been deeply troubled by the climate crisis. I've been inspired by the movement of new generation activists around the world, whether it's in the form of Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil, Dernière Génération in France, Insulate Britain, these new movements of civil disobedience, many of them led by young people. And to me, it's upsetting and also inspiring to see young people sacrificing so much, facing harsh consequences themselves to try and prevent a crisis that really their generation did not cause. It was my generation that caused this crisis. So that is part of the motivation I felt in Ottawa these past few days, seeing young people on the front lines and feeling very much called to stand with them and to do what I can to step forward. Protests are small. There have been four actions. There have been about 16 people arrested so far. But one should remember that many of these struggles started small. I think the Freedom Riders, who were so influential in protesting segregation laws in the United States in the 60s, had, someone told me, their first demonstration had 13 people. And we know how the civil rights movement built. And we remember this week, in fact, 60 years ago today, the March on Washington, which had 250,000 people in attendance, and the organizers had no clue that that many people would attend. So, it takes organizing, but it takes, I think, a few people to step forward and show their friends and family and community connections that the crisis is serious and that we can make a difference if we work together to resist the continued destruction of our planet.
So the cops finally showed up this morning. What happened?
Oh, they came and everything calmed down. Drivers stopped trying to almost drive over us. And it was fairly quick. They said, if you don't move, you'll be arrested. You'll be charged with mischief. None of us moved. One by one, they cuffed us. They dragged us over to a cruiser that was nearby. I sat with another protester in the back. We sat in the back of the cruiser for probably an hour and a half. Technology has changed since I was arrested first 40 years ago. Now they have computers in their cars. They take all the information. They even process the forms in the car. And they were ready to let us out on the condition that we not come back to the district of Gatineau, which is a fairly large district, and we don't fraternize with the others who were arrested with us. We chose to have a chat with our lawyer before signing, so we were taken to a police station for 30, 45 minutes, spoke to our lawyer, signed the conditions, and I was kindly given a ride out of Gatineau, where I am not welcome to return, and into the city of Ottawa by the two police officers who arrested me, who I have to say were cordial, kind, considerate.
Michael Polanyi, what would you and your group like the Trudeau government to do? What are you asking the Trudeau government to do concretely?
There are two initial demands that we've been pushing this week. The first is for a national firefighting agency of 50,000 people. We'd like to see that put together before next summer. I'm sure listeners have been watching the wildfires in Canada, and the largest area of forest has been burned ever. The emissions associated with these wildfires in terms of greenhouse gases are massive, the equivalent of twice Canada's total emissions, happening in a few months. And part of the problem is Canada relies on volunteers and support from other countries to fight fires. Canada is also, I believe the number is 70% of wildfire service folks in Canada are volunteers. So we've seen a huge problem. Usually in a forest fire season, one area will burn. People can come from provinces around Canada to that one area and help fight it, and then move on to another province when fires spread elsewhere. What we've seen this summer is fires in all provinces, all territories of Canada. And we've also seen fires in Europe, in the United States, and other parts of the world. So other countries have needed their volunteer and professional firefighters at home. And so there's a huge shortage of firefighters. Four firefighters have died in Canada. So that's a key demand, is to make sure that this kind of massive out of control wildfire experience does not happen again. And part of that is a well-trained force to fight those fires once they start. Of course, also we need to reduce emissions rapidly to prevent the heating and drying of our forests, which make them more susceptible to fires. So that's the first demand, firefighters. The second demand is something that Extinction Rebellion over recent years has asked for, and that's a citizens' assembly, a randomly selected group of citizens that are representative of the population that deliberate together and develop an emergency climate plan. The reason we're asking for this is that we've seen over the past couple of decades that government plans are both weak and not fully implemented. And part of the reason for that is in our country, Canada, the biggest sort of lobby force is the lobby force of fossil fuel industry. They put a huge amount of pressure on politicians not to take strong action to reduce emissions associated with fossil fuels. So the idea behind the Citizen Assembly is that it would be insulated from fossil fuel lobbying and influence. It would be a binding plan. It would be a plan developed by citizens who, by and large in Canada, are deeply troubled by the climate crisis and want strong action for Canada to do its part to cut its emissions by at least 50% in the next few years, this decade, and to be a leader on climate change rather than the situation which is currently the case, whereby Canada's emissions have increased by about 15% since 1990. And even since 2005, they've only declined minimally. So Canada has not been a leader in addressing climate change. And I think most citizens in Canada want it to be a leader.
Is there a history of citizens' assemblies being organized in Canada?
Yeah, there have been some. There has been a kind of citizen assembly budget process, a participatory budget process in Ontario. And I know there have been others. I think there have been some around healthcare. So there is a kind of expertise and a tradition in Canada of citizen assemblies.
This morning, Michael Polanyi, during your demonstration on the big highway leading into Ottawa, did anybody express the support for what you were doing?
You know, Dave, it would have been probably, we could have done better in that regard, to be frank. We had minimal numbers on the site. And part of the reason we didn't have a lot of people like handing out literature, which would have been a good thing, was just that we were going to do an action yesterday. The police were following us as we were preparing. So we had to be very quick and very inconspicuous in order to actually get onto the road. So we didn't bring a lot of people to play the role of speaking to passersby. The motorists were very angry and so a little bit difficult to engage. I did have one conversation. There was a construction worker who came by and said, you know, what are you doing? And I said, we're trying to bring attention and action to the climate crisis, which our leaders are ignoring. And he said, yeah, that's a good cause. The hope is that we'll get some media coverage. And I think the media coverage to date has been quite strong over the past week. And it has really focused in on that ask for 50,000 firefighters. And I think that's speaking to people, partly because so many millions experience smoke from wildfires in North America this summer. It's concrete. It's something that's achievable. The leader of the NDP, Jagmeet Singh, has been calling for a national firefighter force. So have the fire agencies themselves. So it's you know, I think sometimes in these struggles, having a concrete, winnable demand is really important. It breeds success. It builds momentum. Part of the strategy is to identify winnable steps to build this movement into the size that it needs to be for Canada and other governments to actually take action with the urgency that the crisis requires.
Michael Polanyi, will follow your case here at the Green Planet Monitor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for speaking with me, David, and it was good to be with you.
Michael Polanyi studied engineering, physics, political science, and ecology at various Canadian universities. He was an assistant professor of health studies at the University of Regina. He's particularly interested in participatory action research, where people design and implement research on matters that affect them. More about Michael's Citizens Assembly idea in our second half hour and his firefighter idea at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Musicians hungry for airplay, fame, and fortune if they're lucky, head down to the USA. Marcel Soulaudre did that. A native of St. Boniface, Manitoba, Marcel spent a few years in Louisiana and toured the states extensively in search of deeper roots. He moved to lovely Strasbourg, France, on the German border. Johnny Cash is huge there, and Marcel Soulaudre channels Johnny Cash very well. Here's a story about Marcel, a.k.a. M. Soul. I'm sitting in a dimly lit restaurant in a village in Alsace, France, listening to a guy playing guitar. The baritone voice and song are hauntingly familiar. If I closed my eyes, I'd swear this is Johnny Cash. But Johnny died in 2003. Who is this man in black? Marcel Soulaudre, that's who, a singer-songwriter from Winnipeg, Canada, now living in Alsace, who's been paying homage to Johnny Cash in nightclubs across Europe under the stage name M. Soul. In a few hours, he'll be performing to a room full of Johnny Cash fans here in the village of Epfig. A few days ago, Marcel and I sat down for a chat about his career and where it all began in the French-speaking neighborhood of Canada's prairie capital, Winnipeg.
St. Boniface is a cool place in Winnipeg. We speak French, we speak English. It was a place that I wanted to get out of, but I can appreciate it now that I come from there.
And you grew up as an Anglophone. You didn't grow up in a conventionally Francophone family.
Well, there was nothing very conventional about our family. Even by having a name, Marcel Soulaudre, it's a very French-sounding name. But my mother was of American and English extraction, and she wanted bilingual names for all her children. By luck of the draw, having been the seventh out of eight, I ended up with a very sort of French name. But we spoke only English at home. I started to speak French willingly by learning theater craft. I had come to realize then that the reason for my being was music and for me to get up on stage. The reason that I had learned the theater craft was an excuse for me to get on stage.
Marcel found his stage on the sidewalks of Quebec City, busking folk and pop standards. Returning to St. Boniface, he formed a soul band and began performing songs of his own. At Winnipeg's French-language Festival des Voyageurs, Marcel met a Cajun fiddler named Hadley Castile. The encounter changed his life.
They would come up to Winnipeg in February and play the Festival des Voyageurs. I would follow them back to Louisiana and play the Mardi Gras festivals and stay there. I even played the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival with them one year. I soaked up a lot of their music, and it was Hadley that incited me to start writing songs in French. And Hadley, he played Cajun fiddle. He knew all the Cajun songs, but he loved Texas swing. He was a big fan of Harry Schultz. And I later wrote a song about Harry Schultz called J'ai toujours l'écho, which is on the J'avais dans les yeux album. J'ai toujours l'écho. J'avais dans les yeux, co-written by French songwriter Bernard Bocquel, was released in 1995. Marcel's next disc won a Western Canada Music Award. But singing French songs in North America will only get you so far, and Marcel was ambitious. In 2003, he embraced the baritone voice and songs of one of his musical heroes, Johnny Cash, and began touring across North America.
Wanted man in California, wanted man in Buffalo, wanted man in Kansas City, wanted man in Ohio.
No sooner had the tour begun when Johnny Cash suddenly died. Soulaudre spent the next 3 years comforting fans from Saskatchewan to Texas.
Might be in Colorado.
Then, another turning point. In need of a rest, Marcel travels to France to visit family and friends.
Friends had urged me to do a little show in a restaurant. At the end of it, a German guy comes up to me. He says, I want you to come and sing in my club in Germany. And I thought, well, you know, that's flattering. I'd like to do that. I'll go and play in your club, but who's going to take care of the visa? And he said, well, you don't need a visa here in Europe. This is a union. It's one big country. My mind was set. I was going to move to France and get permission to work in all of Europe. There's more people, far less distances, and I get to discover the old world. The old